Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We're going to start the morning learning about an historical moment that was celebrated this past weekend. We'll move on to winter weather, followed by memories of the fair, and we'll finish at Hildene for some cheese. But let's begin with some important history. Slavery has always felt like a concept that, thankfully, this country put aside a long time ago, but it bears noting that slavery existed here for almost 250 years and has only been outlawed for just over 150 years. And have you ever thought about the very first slaves who were brought here from Africa? Where were they taken from, and where were they left? To mark the 400th anniversary of that time, First African Landing Day was established in 2019, and Governor Phil Scott issued a proclamation declaring August 24th, 2019, Vermont First African Landing Day. This past weekend, a celebration was held at the Intervale Center in Burlington commemorating the fourth such event. Joining me to discuss the Vermont First African Landing Day is Reverend Mark Hughes, the Executive Director of the Vermont Racial Justice Alliance. Reverend Hughes, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, Rick. Thank you. It's so good to be back on WDV. Shout out to everybody across Central Vermont. I miss y'all.
It's great to have you back. And listeners, to speak with Reverend Mark Hughes, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Reverend Hughes, first of all, what is First African Landing Day?
Yeah, great question. It's an interesting one because, you know, when you start thinking about this whole idea of slavery and you know, the history of black folks, I think a lot of folks get stuck on just this, the whole idea, I think, is really, it has a whole lot more to do with the positive aspects that came out of the enslavement of black folks. What we know and understand is in 1619, when that ship landed, the White Lion landed in modern-day Hampton, Virginia, is that 20 Africans got off that ship, and immediately they were enslaved. And how we know this is that Secretary John Rolfe wrote these words, the secretary of the Virginia State Company. I think what a lot of folks don't talk about, though, is the fact that these were really skilled folks. Many of them were blacksmiths. Many of them were farmers, masters of irrigation, and so forth. And if we think about, obviously, what we know is what the terrible history we've had with slavery as a nation is there's nothing short of a miracle that would enable a people to still be present and to be as viable as we are today in this nation. So we talk about resilience and we talk about contribution and we celebrate the fact that we're here. But I think there's more of a commemoration aspect that I think is important to understand. The governor got it. He appreciated it. He actually released a proclamation back in 2019. This is the fourth year that we've done it, and we had a blast. This year was we've come this far by faith.
Yeah.
I do think that there's a lot to be learned, though. You know, as we start to take a closer look at what slavery means in the United States. You know, and I think some of these narratives, as comfortable as they are, we probably want to look at the possibility of exploding them at least a little bit.
Yeah. Well, Mark, let me ask this.
Amend the Constitution if slavery was actually abolished, we wouldn't be trying to amend the Constitution. So we do still have slavery on the books in some way.
Yeah, we're gonna discuss that. Let's talk about the White Lion and those 20 Africans who were brought here. First of all, you said they got off the ship and they were enslaved. So where did they come from in Africa and under what pretense? I mean, were they taken? Were they told that they would be going to this new land, to colonize? What got them on that ship, and what were they expecting in that voyage across to North America?
Yeah, interestingly, the Africans, you know, they came from Angola, and they were actually destined to Mexico at the time, and there was a ship that was commissioned. There were a pair of ships that were commissioned. One was commissioned as the White Lion out of the UK, and they intercepted this ship that was delivering these Africans to Mexico, and they actually stole them. They hijacked this ship, and they took the Africans from the ship that was destined to Mexico. Now, there was a storm. These are the things that we know just because of the documents that were unearthed.
Right.
And these ships were separated, and it was one ship ended up in Jamestown, the other one ended up in what is current Hampton, Virginia. Comfort Point was the name of the place at the time. So the pretense under which they were taken, it was, you know, ironically theft.
Mm. And after that ship landed, how rapidly did the slave trade take off in the United States?
What we know about slave trade during that time, and I think and probably the most important aspect of it, is not so much how rapidly it took off, but how immediate it was to take effect, because the writings that we find that are available anyway, what we're seeing is it seems as though they were immediately traded for what they called besticles or articles, or the captain of the ship needed some things, so he traded these people for supplies. What we know after that is there doesn't seem to have been a day in moving forward that Africans were anything but slaves, leading all the way up into the institution of the United States, and then even obviously incorporated into some of the language in the Constitution of the United States, and moving forward for, as you said earlier, hundreds of years thereafter.
Yeah.
We know the House of Burgess was instrumental in this, in terms of defining whiteness and also legislatively mandating that that black folks were less than people.
You mentioned that this ship was headed to Mexico. Had this been a practice that was going on in other parts of the world at the time?
You know, I don't know what the answer to that is. That's an interesting question, Rick. That's an interesting question that I would imagine, and I think that that's probably one of the many areas. You know, it's probably not well known, but only about 2% of folks who came across the Middle Passage ended up in the continent of North America. And we also know, I think it's really super important to understand that, you know, what we're talking about is we're talking about the English colonial prism of slave trade. You know, obviously there was a Spanish colonial prism of slave trade. There was a Portuguese, the one and only original Portuguese prism that we can look through of slave trade, as well as, you know, their conquests and so forth. So
yeah.
It would be incorrect to say that 1619 was the first time that a Blackfoot stepped on soil in what would become North America, but we can certainly say that through an English colonial prism.
Gotcha. And why and how did America become such an accepting place for this kind of transaction? And I apologize for any poorly chosen words that I'm using, you know, but...
Well, Rick, the thing about I laugh at you because you know, I'm just really happy that we're having this conversation on WDEV.
Yeah.
And I appreciate the demographic of folks that we're talking with, and you know, sometimes we just got to get outside of these bubbles and have these conversations, because
right.
You know, there are varying ways in which this will be received. Some people will completely reject it. Some people will embrace it. What I love about your listening audience is that this is a this is a conservative but moderate listening audience and reasonable listening audience. Absolutely. And I think, you know, if it weren't for many of the folks that are listening today, much of the work that we've gotten done over the years would have been left undone, because there's just a bunch of folks that are out there who are dialed in right now and they're listening and they're interested. And they want to be a part of what it is that we're doing, and they've been a part of it. As far as you know, what it is that we're doing in this work and how we're doing the work, I think I'll just pivot just a little bit.
Sure.
Is this is really important, this kind of conversation, this and the knowledge, because what it establishes is our understanding on why we are who we are today as a nation. It's really important, so I so much appreciate you bringing me on, because when we start thinking about the adverse racial disparate outcomes in housing and education, employment, and health services access, even though it's almost cognitively one wants to be dissonant from the fact that there is a resident and a residual impact that the institution of slavery continues to have on us as a nation. I mean, it's just so hard to get your head around. It took me 40 some years to get my head around it, and I'm still continuing to. But the realities of this thing that we refer to as systemic racism, which is really the what we call the legacy of this institution of slavery, is so incredibly important as we continue to do the work together. And I think that, you know, it's what's really super powerful about you and the work that you're doing here at WDEV is you're opening this conversation up. This is huge to me. This is kind of probably one of the most important things that I could be doing today.
Yeah.
Is having this conversation. I'm excited. If folks want to hear more about the Vermont First African Landing Day and what it represents, they can go to firstafricanlandingvt.org. And all of that commemoration stuff is up there. You know, we just had the event, but also the 1619 traveling exhibit, the information,
yes,
is up there. And I just want to just flag that, because it's currently residing at the Richard Kemp Center. So the story of this passage, this travel, this interception, this travel, this landing, and also as Africans begin to thrive in Virginia, is all told in this traveling exhibit that we have currently erected at the Richard Kemp Center at 372 North Winooski in Burlington. We're going to open that up from 5 till 7 tonight. Mm. So I just wanted to make sure everybody knows that it's there, the story is told. It's an amazing, amazing piece of work. And its origins is from the museum, the Hampton History Museum. Now, again, Hampton is Point Comfort.
Yeah.
So the exact place that we were talking about, it comes out of that museum, Rick.
Wow. Mark, tell us about the work of the Vermont Racial Justice Alliance.
Absolutely. So we've been around for a little while, and many folks will remember Justice for All, the C4 that we started back in central Vermont. And much of that work, it kind of evolved. It came up with I think through the criminal justice system work that we did in the racial disparities in the criminal juvenile justice system advisory panel. We also created the racial equity executive director's office at the statewide level and a bunch of other work. But then we started kind of a look inward to say, how do we build power, you know, with black and brown leadership in the group. Currently, right now, we've got, I think it's probably about four things that we're doing at the same time. One is cultural empowerment, which the First African Landing Day is the cornerstone of. There's the Richard Kemp Center that came out of some of this work as well. Then there's outreach and education. There's community engagement and support. And then, of course, there's platforms and initiatives. And these are this is the work that we're doing with the policy level. So it's there's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of things going on at the same time. But at the end of the day, what we're doing is we're addressing this thing, like we talked about on the last segment. We were talking about systemic racism, where what we've come to understand is that this is a political and economic divide along racial lines. There's a lot of ways that we can go out and figure out what to do about that, and we've chosen about four of them, and so we keep the plate spinning.
Yeah. Well, can you give a specific example of what you do to try to end systemic racism. As you mentioned, this is, what, 400 years in the making?
Yeah, I mean, just take, for example, platforms and initiatives. One of the things that we've done here in the city of Burlington is also we were instrumental in the creation of the Racial Equity, Inclusion, and Belonging Office here. And it's been through that office that the city has made, you know, many strides in some of this work. You know, we talked about the statewide level in terms of policy. Also, there's been the racism public health emergency work that we've been doing across the state, which really just shines a light on the fact that we've got issues and we want to try to work together to solve them. Staying on the whole platforms and initiatives. There was a joint legislative resolution that spoke of the same. There was a health equity policy that was recently passed in 2001 that is currently in play, where there's a whole commission that's set up to address health equity. And this spans not just for racial equity, but also we've got challenges with homophobia as well as ableism. So there's a kind of a framework of some of the policy work. We can even also talk about some of the community engagement and support work where we've found it a pleasure to be able to assist some of the small black and brown owned businesses with small grants. We work in conjunction with the health department to communicate into our communities those challenges associated with COVID and other health related issues. We currently, from the Richard Kemp Center, we're handing out masks and as well as antigen test kits. So it's just a whole array of activities that the Alliance is currently engaged in. Definitely reach out to us. We definitely need your help. There's a lot of work that we're doing. If you just go out to vtracialjusticealliance.org, there's a contact page that you can fish around on. You'll also find that there's a huge comprehensive data set that's out there. We call them data cards. We've had a data team working with us for quite a few years where you can see the data on the outcomes in many of these systems. I'm talking about the racially disparate outcomes in many of these systems. All of this data is really shocking. If you go out and see it at first, it's really jarring to see just how these disparities are playing out. But yeah, lots of stuff out there. But come out and help us. There's ways that you can volunteer. Info@vtracialjusticealliance.org is a good generic email address where somebody will pick it up. info@vtracialjusticealliance.org. We'd love to have you come out and help. Obviously, there's also a way to give out there as well.
Yeah. I also want to give a shout-out to the BIPOC Business Directory. We spoke with the folks from the Professionals of Color Network earlier this year, and you can go to vtpoc.net and learn about the BIPOC-owned businesses in our communities here in Vermont that you can support. Another great way to work to end systemic racism. Mark, what is the Abolish Slavery Vermont campaign?
Yeah, a good shout out on the BIPOC Business Directory, and a shout out to Tino and Weiwei and y'all folks over there. Yeah. The Abolish Slavery, you know, what those of us who've been following it, you know that Proposal 2, it goes in to address Article 1 of the Constitution of Vermont, and this kind of goes to your opening. You know, I just wanted to displace and kind of rearrange folks' minds around this whole idea of slavery, because the Article 1, which it takes you about 20 seconds to get to in reading in our Constitution, if you start from the beginning, it makes it very clear that slavery was never really abolished, at least not completely here in the state of Vermont for the last 245 years. So this policy has been through the legislature, and it is on the ballot, and it will be called PR2, Article 1. And simply what it does is it goes in and makes it very clear that slavery and indentured servitude in any form are abolished. So we've been running that campaign with our state partners, Vermont Interfaith Action. So shout out to Debbie and Melissa and those folks over there. And we also have our national partners, the Abolish Slavery National Network, as well as Faith in Action. Please come and join us. Abolish Slavery VT is the website. It's called abolishslaveryvt.org. We need your help. on that. We have a pretty good idea that there's going to be a number of folks across the state that are going to vote yes on this, of course.
Well, Mark, I want to make sure people understand. Mark, I want to make sure people understand when you say it wasn't fully abolished, explain, and we only have a couple minutes left, that there are exception clauses. Explain that what that means.
Well, the exception clauses, they permit slavery in the state of Vermont for folks under the age of 21, folks at their own consent, and also you've got folks for payment of debts, fines, damages, and the like. So that's always been a part of our Constitution. It may be appalling to you that for the last 245 years that that's the case, but that is the case. So, no, we've never really abolished slavery, nor has the United States, because there is an exception clause in the 13th Amendment as well. So I just need folks, if you could, please, those of you who are listening, just to dial in on this and understand that this is not symbolic. This is not symbolic. This is very serious, because we've already talked about the institution of slavery, mm-hmm. and we've already talked about the damage that it's caused in the form of systemic racism. That is the legacy of slavery. So morally and legally, what we want to do is we want to make sure that we do our job and for once and for all abolish slavery in the state of Vermont. And I think we can have a good time with this if everybody can come out and come together. We've got the yard signs, the T-shirts. Mm-hmm. You can stop by the Kemp Center and pick them up. Stop by Vermont Interfaith Action. You'll see us in a number of different places. AbolishSlaveryVT.org. Go out there. Find out how you can get involved in this campaign. Let's really raise this up together. You know, again, like I said, we can have a good time with this. But at the same time, we can make a statement together across Vermont that this is not where slavery belongs. It never has been the intention. And what we want to do is we want to try to work together to make sure everybody gets the message on this.
All right. And I want to give everybody the important addresses you gave us. First of all, VTRacialAlliance.org is a place you can go. Abolish Slavery.
VT Justice Alliance.
VT Racial Justice Alliance. Right. AbolishSlaveryVT.org. First African Landing VT.org. Or stop by the Richard Kemp Center. That's on North Winooski Avenue in Burlington. Reverend Mark Hughes is the executive director of the Vermont Racial Justice Alliance. Mark, thank you so much for being on the show this morning.
Thank you, Rick. It's such a pleasure to be here. Have a great day.
You too. We're going to take a break for CBS News. Then we're going to get a look ahead at what we might expect this winter when we check in with Roger Hill. And coming up today at 1, we've got the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman. That's followed by 120 minutes of music with the gracious one, Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. We had a call the other week. Karen in Hardwick wondered what Roger Hill knew about what we might expect weather-wise this winter. Excellent question. So I flashed the bat signal, and Radio Vermont forecaster Roger Hill responded, and he joins me now. Roger, welcome back to the show.
Hey, how you doing, Rick? It's good to be back with you.
Good to have you. Listeners, if you've got a question about Roger's winter weather forecast 5 days before Labor Day, let's go. 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, the email address vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Roger, I'm amazed that you can forecast a week to 10 days in advance. How much accuracy can you forecast with over that length of time?
Well, really, lately, because of the kind of oscillations we're seeing and a little bit different atmospheric chemistry and some of the algorithms that folks use to project, winter forecasting or even mid to long range, is more difficult these days than it was, I think, about a decade ago, simply because we have a little bit more curveballs kind of in flux. And a lot of that has to do with the extra heat in the oceans, A lot of it has to do with, of course, this is all because of extra greenhouse gases and it relates to climate change. So trying to project forward on what the next winter is going to do, for example, or even much past about 5-6 days, has gotten more difficult. And we're going to talk, of course, about the winter and kind of what goes into a winter forecast. I don't have, some groups, the Almanac, for example, The Farmer's Almanac has, they use special things. They talk about maybe some moon cycles or sunspot cycles and whatnot. So I really don't use that. What I can do is try to look for kind of clues what might be happening with a lot of the sea surface temperatures. What's the behavior of the summer, a dry summer, for example, that we've had here in Vermont, maybe catching up a little bit on rainfall in some locations, but it's still pretty dry. So there's a lot of little bits and pieces that kind of go into these forecasts. And I have to say that a lot of folks, they're putting together some winter forecasts right now. I would take it with a grain of salt. Normally, That's kind of what we do anyway. And certainly, the winter is not going to behave all in one stretch anyhow. You're going to have, chapter one, 22 chapters
right.
of winter. Now, what does that mean in a sort of homogenous way? It's all over the place. It's going to be all over the place, and that's typically how winters are nowadays anyway.
Mm-hmm. And when you do start taking a peek and trying to get, that idea of winter and how it will look, how do you start that, or when, first of all, and how?
Yeah, let's discuss that because it is kind of interesting, what goes into a winter forecast. So typically I like to do my winter forecasts toward the end of the month of October, and people are saying, well, yeah, you're getting pretty close to the winter. Yeah, I am, but hey, I want to see what's going to happen on the other side of the planet because they hold the keys, and it's up in Siberia is one location where there is this formula that's put together by some really smart people, smarter than me, Judah Cohen at MIT in Massachusetts there. He is kind of done a lot of research and a lot of research with collaboration with some of the folks in Europe, some of the top scientists, climatology and whatnot, have come together where they've discovered that the trends on how fast the snow covers the northern part of Siberia during the month of October is an indicator. And so that's one thing we use. And so, of course, we won't have any information to really work with until we get maybe into the third week of October to kind of get an idea. Are they seeing a tremendous amount of snow? If they don't see a tremendous amount of snow, typically what ends up happening is this kind of a trough and high pressure system couplet sort of next to each other over Eurasia will not get going. But if it does get going, that can cause sort of a reflection back into the upper parts of the atmosphere and work with the stratosphere. And I've talked a little bit about this. Folks have probably heard me talk about sudden stratospheric warming. And sudden stratospheric warming is this kind of energy that goes straight up over the North Pole, the Arctic, and it interacts with the stratosphere, and then it kind of boomerangs back down to into the troposphere where the weather is below, say, the tropopause, or let's say, just on average this time of year, roughly about 38,000 feet. And in the wintertime, it's more like 25,000 feet. So all of this business upstairs then boomerangs back down to the surface. It takes about 2 weeks, sometimes 3 or 4 weeks, and then it causes the polar vortex to either strengthen or weaken. This particular sudden stratospheric warming event will cause it to weaken. If there are no sudden stratospheric warming events taking place, the tendency is that the polar vortex is much stronger over the pole. What that does is it pulls, keeps all the cold air sort of intact over the North Pole. That's really good for sea ice formation. That's good for Greenland and not melting out a lot of ice and then making more ice and this kind of thing. If we have that sudden stratospheric warming event, that boomerang into the stratosphere, and this is all related to how fast the snow is being laid down in October. I know it's crazy, but these are one of the tools we use. Then that sudden stratospheric warming event will cause the polar vortex to weaken. That polar vortex will sort of release its very cold Arctic air. And in some locations, not, that's the other sort of part two to this. You have to have a nice, flow that is going to develop, east of a ridge or to the west of a trough of lower pressure. And if that sets up, then we can get this big flux of super Arctic cold coming into, eastern North America, let's say Vermont, the northeast United States. All I have to do to illustrate the point is, if you remember what happened a couple years back in Texas in February,
Right. Well,
that was one of those setups where you had the Arctic air get stuck and the trough of lower pressure just stayed there, and they, of course, received anomalously cold Arctic air in the places that they normally don't see it, and that went all the way down, in, I think, into, like, central parts of Mexico. So that was what Texas received, and that was all interrelated to what I'm talking about here. So putting a winter forecast together, you have these kind of giant curveballs that at some point in time, some part of the winter will make that winter feel extremely cold, and that's what people will come away with and likely remember.
Mm. Let's take a call. We've got Fred on the line from Newbury. Fred, go right ahead.
So it appears to me that extreme cold is a lot more deadly than extreme warm. What would you say, and why?
Well, we're kind of warming things up. We're having heat waves all around the world now. So I forget exactly how many folks have died in Europe with the heat wave. You get hypothermia, or the temperature's too warm and you can't sweat out, and it kills people that way. Your organs shut down, the body shuts down, basically. And so heat is a killer. Lightning's a killer. You know, flooding rains are killers. Of course, these are related to climate change. But even severe cold can be related to climate change. Why? Well, this whole setup I'm talking about. Up in the Arctic, the sea surface ice, the ice that covers that particular area, if it's open due to climate change and warmer sea surface temperatures kind of creeping into parts of the Arctic, well, then you open all that energy up, and that energy interacts with the polar vortex again. And that's what kind of happened also with the big Texas outbreak. And, of course, their infrastructure wasn't ready for that, and it locked in. And that's what we're also seeing. So these things are all kind of interrelated. But as far as cold versus warm, well, you can freeze to death, but you can also die from heat as well. And lately, it's the heat that's really being turned on because the climate is warming as a whole.
And you've been talking about the temperature of the oceans, how destructive that has been. You know, draw that direct line between, what's happening in our oceans, the warmer temps, and how that affects the weather we've been seeing.
Sure. There's several ways to look at it. So the fact that we're going into, our peak of tropical cyclone period is the 10th of September, and we've had kind of an oddball kind of scenario going on with the tropics kind of getting very, very quiet during the month of August, and then all of a sudden it's starting to rev up. Well, of course, tropical cyclones, tropical depression, tropical storms, strength intensity, and then hurricane strength intensity, and then category 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all of that is related to the sea surface temperatures and the latent heat that those storms work with. So the warmer sea surface temperatures, the stronger the storms typically. Mm. What else it has to be in play is, we hear this a lot, of course, La Nina and El Nino.
Right.
So La Nina is the cold sort of realm that causes the cold waters across the subtropical Pacific, and that interacts with what goes on in the Atlantic. Typically, when we have a La Nina, we don't have as strong jet stream blowing across the Atlantic in the subtropics, so therefore those jet streams will not interact with the developing tropical depressions and cyclones and whatnot, and they more or less stay intact. With a La Nina, because we have an absence of subtropical jet stream winds aloft that shear the tops off the thunderstorms and really don't allow them to form. And when you can't get a kind of a symmetry, more of a circle with a tropical depression in the latitudes, the lower latitudes there, you're going to get much better development, and you're going to jump up those wind speeds to tropical storm or hurricane strength. The opposite of that is El Nino, El Nino's the warm sea surface temperatures in the subtropics of the Pacific, but how it relaxed to the Atlantic and our side of the continent, that blows the tops off of those thunderstorms, and typically you have a hurricane season with very few named storms, or fewer named storms. Lately, we've had a lot of La Niñas, and we've had a little bit of an oddball year this year. It's probably climate-related, but we won't know until there's more study done. But needless to say, it is one of those kind of situations where, you know, we're going to see a tremendous amount of warmth in the oceans. And then, of course, that plays a role on any kind of thunderstorm activity that's pushing into the region off of, you know, the coast or whatnot, working up the eastern seaboard. And in the winter, that causes more of a wet snow scenario. So it's combinations of the different things working, and it's all worked off sea surface temperatures, starting with El Nino, La Nina, and then also what's going on way up at the pole. Those two things interact a lot.
Wow. Roger, I know in the past I've heard you say things like, this will be a backloaded winter with more snow events coming later in the winter, March, April-ish. And you've been right. So what kinds of clues do you pick up that tip you off that, you know, that would be the trend during a particular winter?
Yeah, it's a lot of it is the behavior of the season before that you can kind of work off of. And the fact that we've had one of the anomalies that you can use, of course, is I mentioned the dryness. We're kind of in sort of drought, and some parts of New England have extreme drought. You can factor that in. Also, a warmer than normal summer. We've had plenty of 90-degree days, even in the Barrie-Montpelier EF Knapp Airport, registering 90 a lot more. And, of course, that's all part of a warming climate. But it's also regional. Not everywhere does it warm up. Some areas get actually a little cooler because there's a little bit of different kind of feedback processes that go on. And so, you know, sea surface temperatures are typically what we look at, El Nino, La Nina. I mentioned the, you know, curveballs or the polar vortex, sudden stratospheric warming events based off of how fast the snow is laid down in Siberia, what kind of clues that goes into. There are other anomaly things that you can look for. Some people use sunspot cycles. We're in sunspot cycle 25, and we're going to peak out, I think, over the next couple of years or whatever. And that is used. I don't use that. That's something that's a little beyond my research level. I'm more of an operational guy, so I'm looking more at what the models are putting out. And I'll just give you an example right now. Over the next 3 months, the European model says we're probably going to see a warmer than normal September, and that kind of follows suit of where we've been. The climate forecast system, the GFS, is based off the American models, GFS model, is forecasting a much cooler September. Okay, so there's something that might be interesting there. There's so many things that go into these forecasts and teleconnections. We talk about the polar forecast, the polar vortex, and whether or not the polar vortex has the Arctic oscillation is a plus or minus. A plus means the polar vortex is real strong. It's hugging in a lot of the cold air. It's not releasing the cold air versus the other opposite where it's weak and it releases the cold air into the lower latitudes, hence 45 north latitude around our neck of the woods. That's why we see sometimes strings of nor'easters. Typically that has a lot to do with you know, the release of that Arctic air. You have to have the cold and the interaction near the warm, and it's that baroclinic zone that has sort of extreme temperatures, really cold to the north and really warm to the south. You're going to spin up an area of low pressure. You're also, that's where you're going to find the jet stream. And really, it's the jet stream configuration, which is what we like to use a lot to simplify things. But there's always curveballs within curveballs. So it's a very complex set of issues. And I would say, I would just put this out, that any forecast that you hear about the winter right now, take it with a grain of salt.
You're starting to sound like Spaceman Bill Lee. There's always curveballs within curveballs. Have you looked at trends over the past winters to see how our winters may have been affected by climate change?
Oh, yeah. Our winters are in flux just like everywhere else. So it depends on where the troughs and the ridges set up. But as I mentioned, that those warmer sea surface temperatures that are off the coast, the warmer than normal temperatures, even though they might be in the, say, 50s or 60s, you know, during, say, January, that's a significant deal. you know, sea surface temperatures warm. And so when you get a flow over those warmer temperatures and it's really cold in the interior parts of the continent, and a lot of that can be over the northeast United States, well, you get those extremes. So what ends up happening is you get really super wet snow in those kind of storms. Why? Because the feed is coming in off the ocean, off of south of Long Island, southeast of Nantucket. It's pulling in all that extra warmth and all that tremendous amount of moisture. What does it do? It causes wet snow. And for us, it's a danger. My field, being a weather hazards forecaster in the utility business, that is a, you know, dead reckoning kind of thing, where you're going to get wet snow, and wet snow loading is one of our bigger things that causes power outages, much like an ice storm, or much like severe thunderstorms, or, you know, that anything else, high winds. So you can get tremendous power outages, and so wet snow loading is on the increase. So all the statistics show that we're warming up the planet, and with that, we're seeing more wet snow, which used to occur more into parts of southern New England, less so into parts of Vermont, and we don't have the infrastructure for that because we have a lot of trees, and trees load up with snow, and they bend, and then eventually they break, and they fall onto power lines and whatnot, and that causes power outages. So in that sense, the data is there showing we're increasing that. We're also increasing more and more freezing rain events as opposed to, you know, straight old snow.
Right.
None of us like that. We're seeing a lot more ice, less, you know, and you're seeing a lot of these warm air advection storms that start out with snow. It dumps maybe 2, 3, 4, 5, 8 inches of snow. Boom, it changes to sleet and then freezing rain and then rain on top of that. Then the cold front comes on through, refreezes everything, and boom, you got a big crust of snow. Skiers don't like that. Snowshoers don't like that. Dogs don't like that. The wildlife don't like that. We're seeing more and more and more of that kind of business as well.
Mm. And we got about a minute left, Roger. During the winter months, do you or the National Weather Service have a network of, I'll call them citizen scientists, who are reporting snow totals to you to get a picture of how we're doing around the state?
Oh, yeah. We love data. Of course, the more data there is, the better. We still have some data holes in some parts of Vermont, I think over toward Addison County and in some parts of the sort of down toward Rutland and, you know, those particular sparse areas where there's not a lot of population, there's typically data holes. So we have observers called that work with COCORAS, which measure, you know, all kinds of elements of precipitation, temperature, and specifically more precipitation. We're looking for snow totals, rainfall totals, et cetera, et cetera. So we try to fill those data holes in. And, of course, all that data goes into the modeling, so it's really, really important.
Mm. And, Roger, do you ski, ride, or sled?
I am a snowshoer.
Oh.
I made it to intermediate level skiing, and it just got a little bit too expensive, and I don't like ski boots, and of course that was back when they really hurt your feet.
Yeah,
so I kind of dropped out of that.
I get that. Radio Vermont forecaster Roger Hill's website is weatheringheights.com, and don't forget to check out Roger's Weather Classroom. The podcast is at wdevradio.com. Roger, thanks for being on the show again.
My pleasure, Rick.
Take care. Let's take a break for CBS News. We'll get an update and then have some fun at the Champlain Valley Fair. And the Sox have one more game in L'Étoile du Nord against the Minnesota Twins. Our coverage commences at 6:40. First heave is at 7:40. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Sengary. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at wdevradio.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. There's something about when it's fair time in your town or county. There's funky music in the air, special lights flashing nearby, food smells that aren't always hanging about, and people have a special lilt in their step, a little extra giddy up, because they know that after work or at the end of the week, they're headed to the fair. A new book in the Images of America series is out right now, written by Stephen Meese, that focuses on the colorful history of the Champlain Valley Fair. And Stephen Meese joins us now to talk about it. Steve, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you'd like to share memories of the Champlain Valley Fair, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-TALK, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Stephen, how did the whole idea of the Champlain Valley Fair come about?
Well, actually, it grew out of a fair that was held up in Essex Center, the Grange Fair. I think it started in about 1914, 1915. And over the years, that started to grow and get more popular up there. But the area they picked for the fairgrounds were just not suitable. It wasn't big enough. If it rained, it got very muddy. And so around 1921, they decided to start looking around for a new space, a new fairground. And in 1922, after some searching and working with all the folks in towns around Chittenden County, they landed in Essex Junction, its current site.
And why was that site chosen?
It was flat. It was available. It was a farm that was available to purchase. And it was located close to the Five Corners Railroad. The trolley line would bring folks from Burlington. So it was really a sort of centrally located spot. Still felt like it was out in the country back then, but it seemed to be the place to be.
So once they made the switch from the Grange Fair to the current location, how did that change? Was it the same fair for a while, or what was that early Champlain Valley Fair like?
Well, the first year, they still had to hold it up in Essex Center because the fairgrounds weren't ready. But by 1923, they had built the grandstand. Well, they had the first fair there, and they had the racetrack built. The grandstand wasn't built yet, but they started to add some buildings and get the fairgrounds ready for expansion. By 1924, the first grandstand was built, and they were holding harness racing. There was even an early auto race there, and they had a midway, and they started to bring in all the things that you sort of associate with an agricultural fair, cattle shows, people showing their vegetables and, competing in the canning and vegetable competitions.
Now, it's called the Champlain Valley Fair. It had been, the Essex Grange Fair. So was it designed to have a more regional then or more statewide appeal than the other fair that it replaced?
I think the folks who founded the Champlain Valley Exposition had big plans. They wanted to be a regional draw for New England, for people to come to be at the fair. And, they pretty much have achieved that goal over the 100 years. They were already one of the biggest fairs in New England back in the, just 15 years into operating.
Oh, so that was my next question. At what point, did this fair really take off in popularity, become a major event? Was there something that happened, or it was just that it was building through time?
Well, it was very popular. Almost the first year was at the fairgrounds. I mean, they had, 50,000 people, I think, was the number.
Wow.
Might have to check me on that one, but folks coming from all over, and it just continued to grow. Back then, it was just a 4-day fair. Over the years, it's slowly added days, and until finally, now we're at the 10 best days of summer.
That's right. Let's take a call from Charlie from Middlesex. Hi, Charlie. Go right ahead. You there, Charlie? Oh, we might have lost him. Let's see if we can get Charlie back in. Why was this subject of the Champlain Valley Fair and writing a book about it, Stephen, why was this of interest to you?
Well, I worked at the fair from 2004 to 2008. So I was a communications director. I got to know the fair intimately from, working there and spending, when you work there during the fair, you're there 12 hours a day, 10 days in a row, and just all that goes into it. So, that sort of developed a love of the fair for me. And it's a great photography venue. I mean, I love taking event photos, and, there's no better place than the fair. So when I was working there, they were celebrating their 85th anniversary, which I tried to sort of spin up into an event. But, you know, it wasn't until the 100 was rolling around that I think we finally settled on something bigger. Last year I worked on the history exhibit that's in the State Building, sort of revamped the one that had been done for the 75th anniversary, got that all set up. And after I had gone through all the materials and looked at everything, I went to Tim Shea, who's the executive director, and said, you know, we've got a lot of great material here, and I think it would be perfect for one of these Images of America books. There's just, we have so many good pictures over the history of the fair, and it was a great way to sort of preserve and celebrate the 100 years.
Well, 100 years is a lot of history to dig through. So how were you able to kind of find the historical records of how the fair started and grew and prospered?
Well, I fortunately, there was a good foundation set for me because the folks back in the 75th anniversary had done a commemorative book and pulled together a lot of photos and some stories and things like that. So I didn't have to start from scratch.
Yeah.
But I did. We did have another 25 years of events that had happened at the fair, plus, you know, there were other sources. We looked through UVM Special Collections. The Smithsonian had some photos from back in the 30s. And just there was a rich load of scrapbooks that folks had kept over the years with cutting out the news articles and stories about the fair. And so that really helped sort of fill in some of the gaps and stories.
Oh, I love it. And share with us an interesting nugget or two that you learned about the fair while researching the book.
Well, I guess one of the more fascinating eras for me was back in the, you know, the 30s and the sorts of entertainment that they were bringing to the fair. It was very much the, they would bring sort of vaudeville or Broadway revues of, you know, big dancing troupes and acrobats and shows like that. So that was happening in front of the grandstand. And there were also sort of the specialty acts. One of the things that I found interesting was that there was a gentleman who would daily climb up on a high platform and then dive into a small pool of water. For his last show of the day, he would set himself on fire and then dive into that pool. Just in the last 10 years, there's been an act. There was an act of the Arctic Penguin Show, and for the finale of their show, they would have one of their penguins dressed, you know, one of those fellows dressed as a penguin, light himself on fire and jump into the pool.
So, you're not getting any silly ideas to do that as an act for this year's.
No, I don't have any ambitions to become a terrible actor.
All right, no worries. Hey, let's head to East Corinth. Talk to Forbes. Forbes, how you doing?
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Well, hats off to that fair. I think probably I've seen some of the finest on-stage entertainment that I've seen anywhere, and can always remember that. The one that really stands out is Randy Travis and Tina McBride on the stage at the same time, a number of years ago. But hats off to whoever does the booking.
Oh, that's a great, great show. Thanks for remembering that, Forbes. Stephen, you know, who does put together that great lineup every year of entertainment that we see at the Champlain Valley Fair?
Well, for probably the last 30 or more years, they've worked with a fellow named Bill McGann, who has helped with the booking of shows. But he's been, you know, he's been able to bring in some of the biggest acts around. We've had everyone from, you know, the big Toby Keith country shows to Brad Paisley, Taylor Swift. We've had, you know, great pop shows with Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera, Bruno Mars. So one of the senses of the grandstand is very often you'll see these folks on their way up and sometimes on their way back down is when their acts are doing their revival shows.
Yeah.
So we've put together a list of the 50 top shows. Just Nathanoigo takes us back to 1972. And there are just some amazing names of people who played at the fair.
Oh my gosh. And are they listed in the book?
They aren't in the book, but you can see this list in the, history exhibit that's in the state building at the fair.
Gotcha. Stephen, was there ever a point where interest in the fair waned and it looked like it has, you know, might be that its time had come and gone?
Oh, I don't think so. I think every, you know, the fair's managed to evolve over the years to match people's different interests and different sensibilities, but it's always continued to grow. And that, you know, some milestones in the history of the fair was back in 1965 when the original grandstand burned. They still were able to have the fair that year. And the next year they built the new grandstand, which is the one that's currently serving the fairgrounds. And then also the addition in the early 2000s of the Bobby Miller Expo Center.
All right.
Gave the exposition really a year-round presence in the community. So it's able to hold a lot more events all year round. It's the home of Nordic soccer, and the indoor soccer. And just shows like the Vermont Farm Show, the Vermont Flower Show, antique shows. Those things really sort of fill in the year. And over the summer, they hold concerts out on the Adsit Mall.
Right.
In the Midway. So it's really a year-round operation there now, much different than in the early days when it was really only open for the fair.
Boy, as you mentioned that, I was thinking I've seen plenty of roller derby. I've been to the Junior Iron Chef competition a number of times. There's concerts, there's futsal, a lot of things going on there. I drive past it quite a bit and see signs leading people in for a flea market or something else. Yep. Just about any week or weekend. It is as robust as ever. Go ahead.
It really played a critical role in the community during the COVID shutdown at all, because they actually set up a mobile hospital area that could have been used for overflow if necessary.
Right.
And, you know, they used it to distribute food boxes, and it was also one of the largest sites for getting immunized with the vaccine. So, even when it couldn't hold its normal activities, it really played a big role in the community.
Oh, boy, excellent point. I keep forgetting about that pandemic thing. I'm trying to put it behind me quickly, but that was vitally important at the time, so I'm glad you brought that up. Was there anything that you learned about the fair that surprised you or particularly fascinated you that you found in your research?
Well, one of the interesting things I hadn't realized until I started doing the research was that the fair wasn't held during World War II. For 2 years there was no fair, and then it took a pandemic to close the fair down for another year in 2020. So out of the 100 years we've been there, there's only been 3 years without a fair. That was one of the interesting things. There's the number of carnival troops that have been there. There's been 9 different carnival shows. Most recently, we have the Straits shows, which puts on a great midway.
Mm-hmm.
There was the King Reed shows back in the 50s, which was a Vermont-based carnival. Lots of stories about, lots of folks remember. Also, one of the other carnivals was the World of Mirth. And they used to arrive, they moved their carnival around the country using rail cars. So they would pull a 50-car train into Essex Junction and start unloading all the equipment for the rides and the booths and all and the animals. And they would come, you know, parade them down, essentially down Pearl Street, Route 15, to the fairgrounds from up in the Five Corners.
I think I want to revive the World of Mirth. I love that.
Yes.
Boy,
well,
go ahead.
They were very figuratively. There would be stories in the flyers saying, you know, they had, you know, 1,000 tons of fun were there. And, So it was, you know, very hyperbole, but I would love to go back and see what those old carnivals looked like.
Mm, indeed. Tell us about those original grandstands, because there are photos in the book, and those crowds from back in the day look incredible.
Well, it was. There's a well-known Burlington area photographer, Lewis McAllister, who is known for his panoramic shots. And there's a shot we have in the book of, I think it's the second year of the fair, and it looks like there'd be 4,000 to 5,000 people in the grandstand there, probably for harness racing. So the first year or two of the grandstand, there was no roof on it. Then they put the roof on it, and it stood there for another 40 years until July 11th, 1965, when somehow it caught on fire, and within minutes, within 20 minutes or so, it was fully engulfed and on the ground. Mm. So it was an old wooden structure that burned very quickly. It was fortunate that nothing was happening at the time. There were no folks in the grandstand.
You mentioned the photographs, and I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that some of your wonderful photography has made the book. But is this the first book to your credit, Stephen?
Technically, yes. probably 20 years ago, I worked on a project that I was sort of the editor of it was called the Champlain Valley, and it was a collection of other photographers' photographs. It's a full-color book that was kind of a promotional thing. It was supported by businesses buying advertising in it as well. So technically, but this is the one that I'm probably proudest of and has my name on the cover. So I'm happy to say it's my first book.
Brilliant. Now, I love that it was billed as Vermont's most interesting exposition in 1930. When did it adopt this moniker of the 10 best days of summer, which we have now?
I don't have the exact data when that came in. I mean, there's always been a lot of different mottos or branding of the fair over the years, but I'd say probably within the last 10 or 15 years, it's a line that's kind of stuck, and I think people really associate it with the Champlain Valley Fair now.
Yeah. And so there's the Tunbridge World's Fair, which dates back to the 1800s, and Tunbridge had, I'm going to try to put this as delicately as possible, a semi-racy reputation because of particular shows that went on during the fair. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Sure. The burlesque, or sometimes they call them the girly shows down on the Midway.
Right. And I believe the young boys would go up on the Ferris wheel to try to get a peek behind the show. But did the Champlain Valley Fair also skate close to that moral edge at any time?
I think they did. There's actually a couple pages in the book there. There was a fire on the Midway. One of the tent shows had caught fire, and it was called the Gaiety's Girls or something. But it was definitely sort of a female entertainment show. No one was hurt, but there happened to be a news photographer there and caught the fire and the reaction from the performers. So that's a little interesting. But there was definitely girly shows. There were also sort of a sideshow. There was some folks of pictures of the strange folks, sort of the P.T. Barnum style, what they would call freak shows. So, that all existed. It was a different time. There was a different sensibility, and those things are pretty much gone from most of the reputable fairs and expositions.
Yeah. We've got about a minute left, and we can't ignore the important role that agriculture plays in the fair. So tell us about that.
Well, it really started as an agricultural fair, and at the heart of it was, to celebrate Vermont's agricultural heritage and the people who are doing the work, the farmers. There's still 4-H cattle shows. There's a 4-H horse show coming up at the end of this week. And it's, the tradition of the kids in their white uniforms showing their cows in the ring really lives on and continues to be celebrated there.
And when the fair opens up and rolls around each year, is there something you've got to have? Is it the sausage sandwich or is it the deep fried taco? What's on your menu?
Well, there's always a stop at the maple sugar shack a maple creamy, maple donut. It's also at least once I'll stop by the Piggy Bar, which is one of the longest running concessionaires there back from 1947, to get a Piggy Bar corn dog. They've got the recipe down, and it's always a treat.
Oh, I love it. Stephen Meese is the author of Champlain Valley Fair in the Images of America series, and you can find it at many local bookstores. Stephen, I want to thank you so much for sharing the story with us today.
Sure. It's available at the fair at the Homecrafts area. So you get the special fair deal on the book.
Ah, excellent. So when you're at the fair, get the book on the fair. Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you.
All right. And a reminder that tomorrow morning at 9, we'll have our next book show on Vermont Viewpoint. Let's head to CBS News, and then, well, it's on to Hildene for some Chev. And coming up today at 11, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. Hildene in Manchester is a beautiful place. The Lincoln family home is the former summer home of Robert Todd Lincoln and his wife, Mary Harlan Lincoln. The home is stunning, as are the gardens surrounding it. And there's so much to explore there, including the creamery and cheese-making operation. Did someone say cheese? And that's where we're headed this morning. Joining me now is Peg Gallup, Hildene's creamery manager and head cheesemaker. Peg, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hello. Thank you very much for the opportunity to highlight our cheese and Hildene.
You're welcome. We also have Misty Hosley, the Hildene Farm Goat Dairy Manager. Misty, great to have you here as well.
Thank you for having me, Ray.
All right. I'll try to get your name right for the next 20 minutes. Listeners, to ask our guests about the goats and the cheese at Hildene, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Peg, I want to make sure of one thing. This is I want to understand this correctly. Are you the head cheesemaker? Are you the head cheese maker? Because they're two completely different things.
That is true. I don't make head cheese, although it was my mother's favorite.
same with my father. All right. And Misty, I'm sorry, tell us about your role at Hildene.
I manage the goat dairy, so I take care of all aspects pertaining to the goats, their health, their maintenance, and the maintenance of the land also.
Now, both of you have some interesting backgrounds. Peg, I'll start with you. Tell us about your background in cheesemaking.
I've been making about 25 years now, and started out at another small creamery. Got my love of cheese there. I started and from there moved on. I had the opportunity after a couple of years to plan this creamery. So it's been here I was here for 9 years making, and then took a hiatus, went to a couple other bigger creameries, and found out that coming back home to a smaller creamery has much more impact on the quality of the product. So that's where my heart is, putting out top quality products. So I'm very, very happy to be back here again making fresh hemp.
How long has that cheesemaking operation been going on at Hildene, Peg?
The barn planning started around 2006, and our very first make here was Christmas Eve 2009.
Oh, that's exciting.
And we've been making steady since then.
And Misty, tell us about your background.
I grew up in northeastern Pennsylvania on my family's small farm. Moved here to Vermont in 1997. My husband and I bought his grandparents' farm in East Arlington, Vermont, about 10 years ago, and thought maybe we would want to add goats for some brush clearing. And I knew nothing about goats at the time. So Peg was actually the goat dairy manager at the time, and she was kind enough to let me volunteer. And it was actually during kidding season. I started at 11 in the morning, and I didn't leave until 11:30 that night, and I was hooked. So I volunteered for a little bit with Peg, and then she hired me to be a farmhand, and I, on the job training, she's taught me so much. She's just such a wonderful mentor, and I'm learning more every day.
Oh, that's beautiful. And who can tell us maybe a little bit of background on Hildene itself?
Well, we are a educational center. There is a museum here that houses thousands of historical documents and items pertaining to the Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
We have the Pullman car that's here. That was Robert Todd Lincoln's business. He made his fortune basically in the railroad that was booming at that time. And the Pullman cars were the, like, elite transport and vacation, entity at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have one of those here on site. We have education centers. We do a multitude of programming, everything from farm camps to a lot of agricultural camps. Can you, Misty?
Yeah, so we have 412 acres that's opened to the public from Thursday through Monday, 10 in the morning until 4:30 in the afternoon. With your admission, you have access to the entire property. Mm-hmm. We also have the lower portion of our property, the Dean farm. There we have Randall Lineback cattle, sheep, alpacas, chickens, pigs, and a beautiful greenhouse and vegetable and flower farm down there as well. We also collaborate with the local high school, BBA. We offer classes with them down at the Dean Farm. We also have a large group of volunteers across property, from the farm to the office. We're mainly education. We really want to teach people where their food comes from and what it takes to get that piece of cheese or that piece of meat or that egg.
Yeah. And Misty, tell us about the herd of goats that you have there at Hildene.
Well, our herd actually originated with Peg's personal herd. And we still have those lines in our herd. Right now we have 15 milking does. 5 yearlings who are being trained to acclimate into our milking herd. We have 12 doe kids from this year and 5 breeding bucks. All of our goats are registered with the American Dairy Goat Association, and we chose Nubian goats specifically for their high butter fat in their milk. They don't give as much milk as some dairy breeds, but they do have that nice high butter fat.
Ah. And Peg, whenever I talk to goat owners, they tell me how much they love these critters. What is it about goats that make them so adorable?
They look right at you. They work their way into your heart. They're fun. They make you smile. They actually will cuddle you. You get hooked with the kids. And it really doesn't take long. It has really exploded over the last, I would say, maybe 10, 15 years, as far as goat ownership and people enjoying and owning goats. So a lot of them come here also for, how do I care for these things? I love them. And that's where Misty comes into it. And then the people come and volunteer, so it's sort of a dual effort. We get their work, and they get to learn.
Yeah.
Goats are great. That was part of why with Hill Dean, goats are more manageable than the cows. They used to milk cows here years and years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And there actually was a dairy, and that was what we were revitalizing. The goats these days are a little more manageable for people with smaller properties because a lot of people have, you know, maybe 10 acres, 15 acres, and you can certainly have a number of goats in a very small area. They're very efficient on their feed. And be able to milk those goats and make a product for your family and make cheese. And it also, you know, gives the kids some responsibility. And so all the way around. And goats used to have, I would say, sort of a bad rap, you know, that they were maybe not as clean as other animals. And I wanted to change people's minds on that, change people's minds on goat cheese and goats in general. And I really think that Hildeen and everybody here has highlighted that when you come here, it's somebody else had mentioned that they didn't think much of it at first. They came and all of a sudden it was like the best day they ever had was bringing their kids, coming here and spending the day. So it sticks in my mind, and that's what I want people to have. They're a memorable experience and the best day they've had.
That's a great testimonial. Peg, what types of cheese do you make from the goat's milk?
Right now, basically, we're concentrating on our fresh cheb, which we make it plain and also in a maple version. I'm not sure if you got to try that when you were up at the Cheese Summit.
The fresh cheb I did, yes.
Yeah. Yes. And soon we'll be bringing in cow's milk, and we'll be doing a cow's milk tome. And we also do fetas, and we're trying to figure out what other people want. So make sure you call in and tell us what your favorite cheese is so we can plan our next season's menu.
Well, I want to know more about that chev. It was just beautiful. I think when I was trying it, you told me something like, this is the cheese you could start a meal with as an appetizer and finish the meal with as a dessert.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
It goes really well. It basically either plain, it's very spreadable, mix it with herbs. We like that bagel seasoning on it. Anything like that to begin your meal with or as an appetizer. And then if you take it and drizzle maple syrup over it, it truly is a decadent dessert. I say it's the bookends of your meal. You can serve it at the beginning and the end.
Oh, I love that so much. And Misty, do visitors, school groups get to visit the farm, interact with the goats when they come to Hildeen?
Oh, absolutely. We have a program in the springtime when the babies are little. We have quite a few school groups that come in. Dion Newton is our education director. And she, from I think it was beginning of May until mid-June, we had school groups come in. The kids, the human kids, learn right. All about goat care, how to milk the goat, and then we do a little demonstration for them. We have a demo goat named Bianca that we created so we can show them how to milk without actually having to milk one of our real goats, and then they get to feed the babies the bottle.
Mm. And what do the goat kids find fascinating about the human kids?
The goat kids just really love the attention. We put a lot of time and energy into them from the time they're born, bottle feeding them, handling them as much as possible. So the goat kids really look forward to that when they see the human kids. They know that they're going to get attention and they're going to get a bottle too.
Mm. Now, Peg, I don't want to hurt the feelings of those wonderfully playful goats and Misty, but so maybe you can cover their ears. But you mentioned the cow's milk tome. So where do you get the cow's milk from?
We source it from local farms here. Woodlawn has been our go-to for many years, and we're reaching out to a couple of actually smaller and much more local farms to try to, because we bring in such a small volume. We only do 50 gallons at a time, which on a creamery aspect is small, but it also allows like very high quality when you're working with a smaller batch and making, you know, in that capacity. We pay good for the milk, so it allows that farmer to get more than they would ever get by shipping it. And it gets to highlight their milk into the cheese. You can't make the milk any better than what it is. I'm basically just concentrating what's already there. So we search out, you know, quality milking farms and, you know, ask to purchase their milk to make cheese. And it's a nice collaboration between us.
And tell us about Tome, because it's a wonderful cheese, but doesn't get the publicity of, you know, of many of the other cheeses.
No, it's basically a, you know, French word for just basically piece of cheese. and there's so many variations. Every milk source, every creamery, every cheesemaker is going to impact the flavor, also the texture of that cheese. So even though you may purchase Tome from one cheesemaker, it's going to be very different from another. They're all good. The aging facility, also the microbes that are on the outside of the rind and what they may brush it with or wash it with. There's so many aspects to what impacts the flavor and texture of cheeses. The more you get into it, the more there is to learn and to know. And it's exhaustive. You can start out very small and learn a lot and make a really good cheese, and I guarantee you'll be hooked and you'll just want to learn more and more and more as it goes.
I'm so glad.
I'm still not done learning.
I'm so glad you focused on cheese and not head cheese. Misty, the goats have another great role. It's poop, I believe. Please explain.
Oh, yes, we make more every day. We compost our shavings and manure and use that here in our gardens at Hildene, in our vegetable gardens and our flower gardens. So we try to close that circle. And we also, once it's composted, spread it on our fields, too, for fertilizer.
And since I may have wounded a few egos by mentioning those cows. Are there any Gold Star goats that you want to give a shout out to?
Are there any goats that I want to give a shout out
to? Yeah, any that you know, particularly.
Our entire herd. They're all
of course.
Girls. And they definitely all have names. They all have their own personalities. We do have an escape artist named Juliet. She can unlock all of our gates. So we have to double lock everything and jump in and check, make sure that we did so. It's just one of the fun things about goats. They keep us on our toes. We're constantly learning. They show me my weaknesses pretty quickly and help us to correct that. They're always constantly making me a better herdsman. For sure.
And they obviously keep you laughing. Juliet is the first one I want to meet when I get there. Peg Gallup is Hildene's creamery manager and head cheesemaker. Misty Hosley is the Hildene farm goat dairy manager. And to learn more, you can visit hildene.org. Peg and Misty, thanks for being on the show, and give our best to the goats, please.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care. All right, before we end today's show, I want you all to know that this Friday will be my last day hosting Vermont Viewpoint. I've had a wonderful time letting you know all about the wonders and the wonderment of Vermont, but it is time for me to step aside and let the next person up take you different places, literally and figuratively. And I will have time at the end of the show on Friday to say goodbye properly, but I do want to thank you all very much for your kindness. And thanks to everyone at WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group for their support during these couple years. That's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by the amazing Mr. Danny McGivergan. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at WDEVradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sarah is up next. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when we have my final book show at 9 to 10. We'd love to hear your suggestions. We also learn about common roots and art at the Kent.